Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning to our panel discussion on social entrepreneurship. I wanted to give you a heads up and a reminder that next week we'll have another panel. We'll be talking about an innovation in career and technical education that's happening right now at the OCM BOCES in Liverpool, and that's the new Innovation Tech program. So anybody who is interested in education, in career education, in employment and job development and all of that, that should be a very interesting talk. That's a trend that we've been seeing, hearing about nationally, and part of the topic of the current Onondaga Citizens League study. So I also want, and actually one of the things that came out of the OCL study is we talked about how the importance of different means of communication and social media are gaining ground in both for employers and employees. And so Thursday Morning Roundtable is on Twitter. And yeah, so it's TM Roundtable, all one word. And we have hashtag TMR Talk. So if you see any people like Heidi Holtz over here on her little iPhone, don't think that she's being naughty and talking to her daughter or somebody. She's just tweeting about how great TMR is today. So that's it. It's my pleasure to introduce briefly this morning's panel. The handle is TM Roundtable, and then it's the hashtag TMR Talk, all one word. All right. So I want to thank Dominic Robinson, the Executive Director of Northside Up, for putting together today's panel, and that's Dominic at the end. We've heard from Dominic before. He started several years ago with the Franciscan Ministries on the North Side, and then it was the Northside Collaborative, and now Northside Up and Center State CEO, and is involved in all sorts of things. And then we have Mike Malara, who's the Executive Director of the Onondaga County Catholic Charities. Janie Mills, who's a program manager at Social Enterprise Development at Saltworks, and you might have noticed if you came in the entrance over here that there was some of the products of Saltworks. If you didn't have time to catch them on the way in, catch them on the way out, some gorgeous pieces over there. Then we have Adam Sudman, founder and organizer of My Lucky Tummy, and Seth Mulligan, you might have read about Seth, and Stan Lindhorst, Stan isn't here today, Stan's column in the Post Standard on Sunday. Seth is Vice President of Innovation Services for Center State CEO. So I'm going to ask Dominic to please get us started. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sandra. Pleasure to be here this morning. Good to see so many familiar faces again. And we're really excited to share some really cool things that are happening in the Syracuse community with you today. So we're talking today about social enterprise. That might be a familiar term for some of you. For some of you, it very well might not. That's kind of why we're here. Social enterprise is a relatively new idea, and it essentially suggests the idea that there are organizations and companies that are taking innovative approaches and oftentimes market-based approaches in order to create solutions and change on social and environmental issues. The definition of social enterprise is one that is often kind of broad and nebulous in our industry, and so I think it's really important to talk about what we're to kind of define what we're talking about relative to social enterprise today and why we think it's important. A lot of you, you know, might be familiar with a model in our community like the Rescue Mission. The Rescue Mission is, in fact, a form of social enterprise in that it is a nonprofit organization that serves some very critical functions in our community, and it has a set of businesses that generate revenue in order to support that business model or that organizational program model and a lot of other services. So they have thrifty shoppers and other things where you go in and you buy clothes from them and that money goes directly back into their programs and services. That is a form of social enterprise. We also hear a lot about for-profit companies today that are starting to take a triple bottom line approach. So we all know what the traditional bottom line is. It's profit. But a triple bottom line approach also creates metrics and holds companies accountable for their impact on people and the planet. So the three P's often, profit, people, planet. And so there are existing companies out there, Ben and Jerry's being a really great one that, you know, has kind of started to define themselves as a social enterprise. A lot of emerging kind of small businesses in different communities kind of state a very specific purpose. But they started really as for-profit companies that said, hey, we're going to become if we're going to be responsible stewards in our local economy and our community, we need to think about our broader impact. And so that's also a model. But really, the way that we want to try to define it today is a little bit more acutely. And the definition that we'll kind of be using to frame it is an organization that applies commercial strategies to maximize improvements in human and environmental well-being rather than maximizing profits for external stakeholders. So if you can think about this idea of essentially using a business model to improving quality of life and in doing so creating opportunities to better our community. That's really kind of the fundamental premise. And so the business model, in fact, isn't just a revenue generation tool for other nonprofit activities. It, in fact, is the vehicle by which social change is being made. So I think that's a really important distinction to talk about what our folks represent up here today. Within that framework, there are a few different ways that happens. And I think today, you know, loosely kind of defined, we have social enterprises that are here to create opportunities that otherwise don't exist. There are social enterprises out there all over the country that are providing job opportunities and critical experiences for the people that our communities so often find hardest to serve. And so we'll hear about a really great example of that from Mike Malar a little bit later in Project Joseph. There are social enterprises that are also creating experiences for people who have a lot to offer our community but sometimes don't have the right avenues to grow into their fullest role or fullest potential. And so some social enterprises actually are designed to enhance people's skills and give them a higher kind of profile in the community in order for them to be more impactful in the community. So low-income individuals who you know, are somewhat marginalized but have a lot of potential, how does a social enterprise create opportunities for them that they are having difficulty finding otherwise? Both My Lucky Tummy and SaltWorks are very much designed to do that. And then there's social enterprises that are really designed to facilitate entrepreneurship, specifically among our underserved communities. So I think it goes without saying in this audience that there is a ton of entrepreneurial potential that is latent within our inner city communities, amongst our young adult population, but those are communities that have lack access to capital, lack access to resources and networks, and oftentimes are shut out of the entrepreneurial process, and we're not getting to see their ideas realized, nor are we seeing their potential impact on the economy realized. And so some social enterprises are designed, in fact, to facilitate those opportunities in various ways, and that's a big part of what we've done with Upstart Syracuse. So thinking about those kind of as general concepts, there's hundreds of models across the country that fill each of those niches, but those are the niches that we're really going to be kind of focused on here today. And so it's really exciting to be able to introduce those and let you hear from those. What we're really going to try to talk about is what these specific businesses are about, what their aspirations are, and some of the challenges that they face. I think the last thing I want to articulate is that just because these are efforts that apply commercial strategies that are using a business model, I have yet to find one social enterprise that complies with that definition that at least for a long time is financially independent. There are negative externalities that you're inherently introducing. So I'm using some economic language. There are some very difficult things that you're going to encounter when you're trying to accomplish social and environmental goals using a business model. And so, you know, I think that there's sometimes a false expectation that all these things should just be paying for themselves. This is the future of the nonprofit industry. No, you know, we have grants and government programs that kind of help support this type of work for a reason. But these do offer some creative ways to maybe create more diverse funding streams to supplement existing models in the nonprofit community. And so I think that that's just one other piece that I want to make sure is established at the beginning as far as a really important piece of framework. So with that, I want to start with a guy who, quite frankly, has inspired a lot of the work that myself and my team do in this community and has supported a lot of it. And he and I have been talking about social enterprises for the better part of 8 years now. But Mike Malara, Executive Director of Catholic Charities, has taken a very creative approach to some of the more intractable challenges that his organization faces in Project Joseph.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks, Dominic. So our social enterprise is called Project Joseph, and Project Joseph is a property maintenance business. So when you think about that, we provide traditional property services, so interior, exterior cleaning, painting, light construction, carpentry, repair work, lawn service, snow removal. You guys get the drift, so to speak. We named Project Joseph after Saint Joseph, who is the patron saint of work. And work is really the operative term for us. So just by way of background, we serve a lot of people at Catholic Charities. People come to us struggling with poverty. I think we do an excellent job working through crisis that folks have, helping folks get stable. Basically, we help people get back on their feet. But once people get back on their feet, we have to help them stay on their feet. And in order to do that, we have to figure out how to reduce poverty in the lives of the people that we serve. Poverty is a, as you all know, is a very complex issue, but we believe that an important poverty reduction strategy is to provide the people we serve with the opportunity to work, to become employed, and to participate in the economy. Our challenge is that for many of the folks that we serve, because of their backgrounds, conditions, issues that they struggle with, their prospects for employment are not great. So that's where Project Joseph comes in. In Project Joseph, we employ the people we serve, and specifically folks whose prospects for employment are not great. So the Project Joseph team is comprised of men who come from our homeless shelter and some of the refugees that we have resettled. They come to work every day, and they work shoulder to shoulder with professional project management or property management staff. And this team goes out and does jobs, private market jobs in the community. So that's our model. Our business model is based on a couple of different assumptions. The first problem that Project Joseph is trying to solve in terms of the market, we're aware that there are property owners out there, for a variety of reasons, are unable to maintain their property. So Project Joseph in the marketplace is really going to go after those property owners and provide a solution to them in terms of maintaining, helping them to maintain their property. What makes Project Joseph unique in terms of our position in the market, one of the things that we do at Project Joseph is we're willing to take on what we call odd or unusual jobs. And some of them are very strange. And what we're learning is our willingness to take on odd jobs or unusual requests differentiates our business from other property management firms. So, for example, one of the very first jobs that we took on was we moved 3 tons of stone from one side of an apartment complex to another side of an apartment complex. It's really gratifying work. But that property owner could not find anybody to take on that job. And we're learning that there's space in the market for us to take these odd jobs on. One of our upcoming jobs is to plant 400 trees. So that gives you an example of where we think we can live and perform in this market. What's our long-term potential? We're trying to get as many people back to work as possible. So our goal is to try to double our business over the next 12 months. We had hoped to have 10 FTE clients working for us by the end of 2015. We're there right now. We have 10 clients coming to work every day as part of the Project Joseph team. We identify different customer segments out there that we think we can offer a really reliable solution to, and we're starting to market to those customer segments. And finally, our major challenge right now is really trying to ramp up the business and to try to calibrate when we add more staff based on the amount of business that's available to us. And that's part art, part science. So we're trying to figure out when we bulk up based on the demands of the business, and we haven't quite gotten that one right yet. So that's Project Joseph. I think there's pictures of some of our crew. They were working on masonry work and painting a building. I got to tell you, our risk management people just love the fact that we put our staff up on lifts like that. Nobody really talks to me anymore at Catholic Charities. But our slogan is, there's dignity in hard work, and our goal is to help people move from surviving to thriving, which we see as transformative work. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Up next, a project that Mike had no small hand in helping kind of support and sustain in its early period, and is now starting to get off the ground, but is managed by the very dynamic and wonderful Janie Mills of Saltworks.
Thank you. So Saltworks is a furniture company, basically, and we, as Dominic mentioned, we just started. We had our official launch in May, so we haven't been around that long, and as Sandra said, we do have some pieces out in the hallway, so if you haven't seen them, I really recommend you go out and take a look at some of the things that we're building. Saltworks was created in an effort to create a solution to two problems that were outlined in our community by our two parent nonprofits, Northside Up and the Near West Side Initiative. Those two problems were both, one was socially based and one was environmentally based. So the socially based problem was that, as Dominic mentioned, we have a large population of residents in Syracuse that just fall short of meeting the mold to be hireable. And so whether that's more in the soft skills or in the hard skills and technical exposure or lack of employment history, these people have a lot of potential, but we wanted to step in and help them reach their potential. Environmentally, at the same time, we had there's several old buildings that are being renovated in our community. So through that renovation process, there's a large amount of construction debris that is just going directly to the landfill. So Saltworks took those two issues and reframed them as potentials. So instead of saying that we have this population of unemployed people, we saw the value in the human capital of that population and just saw that they needed a hand up. And then from the environmental side, all of the materials that were being written off and as trash and going to landfill, if you really looked at those materials, they had a lot of value. So we took the wood, basically, we're taking the structural timbers that have come out of the two separate buildings that are in the Near West Side, and they're humongous, massive structural beams and columns, and it's 200-year-old old-growth lumber that we're milling down and making furniture out of. And through that process, we're hiring on people and training them in both the soft skills of showing up to work on time and the ability to be comfortable in speaking English, and then also in furniture building skills, which can translate to other skills within the construction industry. So through this process, we're building artisan furniture and selling that to make the profit to continue to return those proceeds back into the community and provide more jobs and continue growing. The potential for this model is great. So immediately, of course, we would like to continue expanding our business and be able to hire on more people. But in the long run, the basic model of Saltworks has a broader potential. So we always have our eyes open with what the residents of our community are able to achieve and what materials can actually be rethought and upcycled into something even greater than what they are originally valued at. So the potential for Saltworks is that in the future, it might not just be furniture. We might go into other products or even into services or something like that, but being able to meet the, you know, find that market niche and bring in people that otherwise wouldn't have fit the mold. Our challenges, however, are, again, both immediate and long-term. So immediately, we have an issue with exposure to customers. Our boots on the ground only go so far, so we're always looking for ways to let more people know about what we're doing and about the products that they can purchase. Long-term, as Dominic mentioned, we're always dealing with a skills gap. We're hiring on people and training them while paying them a full-time living wage, which means that our labor cost is much higher than our competitors. And has, you know, it, in the furniture making industry specifically, people have gotten used to buying from big box stores, and we don't have the scale to meet those prices. And we're paying our people and providing benefits, unlike the big box stores. So long term, there's always going to be a skills gap that we have to make up for. But we hope to continue doing that and continue carving out our market sector.
And I actually just want to quickly acknowledge our two artists and craftsmen for Saltworks. We have Ignacio and Luis. You want to raise your hands, guy? So with Janie, these guys have made all the products that you're seeing up there and out in the lobby, and are just wonderful men and great team members, and we're so proud to have them. And they're actually graduates of our job training programs at North Setup as well. So you gave them a kind of base level skill, recognized that these guys had a ton more potential than entry level labor that we, you know, might be able to get them at that point, and so said, hey, they kind of partially inspired us to build this opportunity for them. So we're really, really proud to have them. Next, we are going to hear from our friend and partner, Adam Sudman, who is the owner of My Lucky Tummy, which for a guy who really loves food like me is one of my favorite businesses in Syracuse, but is very much also dedicated to providing opportunity and showcasing a lot of the you know, kind of hidden riches that we have in Syracuse.
Hi, I'm Adam. I am the CEF of My Lucky Tummy. CEF is a very lofty title, means chief executive factotum. So I am the grocery shopper, I am the dishwasher, I am the janitor, but what I don't do is I don't cook. I'm kind of a meh cook. But what I did find out when we first moved here just over a year ago is that there's this considerable, quite massive and diverse refugee and new American population on the north side. And I had an idea that I bet there's a lot of people who can cook something great living here, and maybe I can go and meet some people, and maybe we can have a party. So that's what we do. Twice a year, we have what we call a pop-up food court. I hire five individuals to cook something from home, just one dish. We invite people to come and sort of take a walking tasting of the world, and we have a lot of fun. We have about we get between 300 and 400 people each time, and then something that I'm very proud of is that we compost like crazy. We compost, you wouldn't believe what they make in compostable form now, even our saran wrap. And so for a party of 420 people that we had back in February, we had a kitchen bag's worth of landfill, and everything else gets folded back into the soil. So because a lot of our people that we are hiring come from places that are on the front lines of climate change, it's a source of great pride and some solace that we're able to not impact that adversely. Anyhow, we have about 21 different countries that work for us at any given time. Each time we have five different people come on board, and we always try to do dessert from a conflict zone. The idea is that if you can have a great dessert from Afghanistan or Iraq or Somalia, maybe life there is fuller and richer and rounder than what we're shown on the television. And maybe the individuals that are coming from those places have, while coming from extraordinary trauma, maybe also have great things to share as well, and that it's worth having these kinds of conversations and meeting people. And I think that's really what our sort of raison d'etre is that food is the excuse to get together, but it's really about conversation. I want to start having people have conversations that wouldn't normally talk to one another, and that's the most exciting thing about our project is that people that's can be very, very isolated because of because of language or other reasons, get to rub shoulders with different people. I have one of my chefs was forced out of Iran because of her religion, and was had a different perspective on Muslims because of that. And because of this process that we've gone through in this party, one of the close friends that she's made in this party is of the Muslim faith, and so we're starting to cross those boundaries. There's a woman from Vietnam that I met the other day that's going to start working with us. She's lived here 7 years, and we met on the corner of Butternut and North Salina, and she didn't know where downtown was. She didn't know where SU was. And it's so exciting to sort of start to integrate her into that conversation with us. She's going to work with us and now meet new people and give what she has to give, not just in food, but in perspective. I think that perspective is the most exciting thing that I'm finding as I meet more and more people. So what I do basically is I drive around the North Side, and I at first it started with me driving around and asking people from the side of my car window, are you from Pakistan or are you from Congo? And that actually didn't work so well, which is shocking, right? There was one instance where some gentlemen started to sort of jog away from me, and I had to get out of my car and run after them, and I was yelling, "Falooda, Falooda." And then they turned around and they said, "Oh, you want us to, if you yell the dish." They're just unbelievable people that you get to meet in this process. So it's a lot of fun. Right now it's just two parties a year. Parties are great. We have one coming up on October 4th. And that's going to be all vegetarian. That's where we've partnered with something called the Salt City Harvest Farm, which is about 15 minutes north of town in Kirkville. And what they've done is they've donated 36 acres of their farmland for individuals from Bhutan and Congo and other places to grow the things they know and love. And so we're starting to sort of go full circle with them and use their produce. So that's really exciting for us. In terms of, challenges and opportunities or challenges and potential, there are no challenges. It's so easy. You just have to, go to about 23 to 25 grocery stores in one day, and then cook in the evening and the next day with people that speak five different languages, and I only speak English, and we all manage to communicate, and then convince 300 or 400 people to come and try your food. So that's all. That's all that has to happen. In terms of our potential, gosh, I really like, I keep coming back in my head to that notion of conversation. We would really like to, I think twice a year we really create that, I don't know if you want to call it an agora or that space where people from different backgrounds get to meet and have conversations. The potential, the dream for us would be to do that in a more permanent fashion, whether that's a food court that exists somewhere or a restaurant. I don't know. But that's what we're hoping for, because it's so great to have that conversation and meet new people twice a year. We could maybe try it 365 times a year. Thanks.
I also just want to quickly point out that one of the great things that Adam does also, much like the rest of the previous panelists, is you pay your chefs well, and really, showcase their talents well. So I think that that's also a really important thing, that this is an opportunity for someone who maybe is on a day-to-day basis working a really difficult and perhaps low-paying job to do something that is very native to their skill set, that they love and are proud of, and to make good money doing it. So I think that there's a real power in that model, and hopefully one that can in fact grow and be more permanent in our community. And so coincidentally, a big part of what we've been trying to do at Northside Up and Center State CEO is create a vehicle by which we can help those types of efforts grow and sustain themselves. And actually, on Monday, Adam is going to be meeting with me and the gentleman to his right, Seth Mulligan, to talk about better ways to utilize our Upstart Syracuse platform and to start developing his business model. And so here to talk about Upstart Syracuse is Seth. And you've heard from Seth in various contexts, and you probably know him as the innovation and tech guy. What you might not know is that a lot of the social enterprise work we've done through Center State CEO and Northside Up and Near West Side Initiative and in other places to date have been very, very much informed by Mr. Mulligan and a lot of his work. And so one of the ways that we're looking to kind of grow our platforms over time is to further embed ourselves in a partnership with the Syracuse Tech Garden and the Innovation Portfolio at Center State. And so here to kind of talk about our initiative Upstart Syracuse, which is about 1 year old, almost to the date, is Seth Mulligan.
Thank you, Dominic. So I think that's on. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Nice to have a chance to engage in this discussion, and wanted to sort of go through a little bit some of the pieces and some of the opportunities and challenges that we've seen in helping co-develop this program. First thing I wanted to say is that there's really a sort of a micro and a macro perspective that Upstart is addressing and tackling. And first, let's look at the macro level. And by macro, I mean more across our community here in Central New York, not, you know, global. But it can be applicable that way. What we're looking to do is sort of find a way to lift up traditionally underserved, or as I'm coming to understand, more just served less frequently type of entrepreneurs. You know, for some language or cultural or financial reasons, these business models these entrepreneurs are creating are just more challenged. But it's not necessarily aligned. You know, they're aligned for success. They're good business ideas. The challenges they face are sort of these, you know, cultural and financial and language barriers, not that they aren't sound and great sustainable business models. So, you know, the tech incubator guy that tries to think about how is this startup going to raise, you know, $500,000 on an idea and a piece of a patent would have looked at social enterprise and been like, you know, not really investable. You know, that would be Seth like 3 years ago. But the more you dig in and you understand that the talent and the perspective and the richness of the talent that drives these business models is way more important than the business model, right? So the macro perspective is tapping that talent pool, tapping that amazing potential, and delivering more sustainable businesses into our community, and sort of navigating those challenges. The micro perspective, and I think is part of the reason that, you know, I'm here explaining this program, is that, you know, how do you make this sustainable, real, effective? Well, you know, okay, let's just put it inside the organization that is often called the business leader, EDO, nonprofit, tech development, chamber, PAC, convention and hospitality service member firm. What I described there is sort of the Center State CEO model, right? There's this umbrella of all these things that it does, right? And so it can be a lost opportunity if you don't look how you cross-leverage all of those pieces. So the micro perspective for me is no matter what the social enterprise, how do we really drive its sustainability? It can't sustain on, you know, the grant support alone. And that gives me the perfect opportunity to recognize that it was some key leadership from the Community Foundation and a piece from ProLiteracy that catalyzed this. And so we owe it to those benefactors to say, once and done, right? Here's how it's going to live on. Here's how it's going to sustain. So macro, creating and finding these business models, eliminating the challenges. Micro is the sustainability piece that keenly gets to leveraging the assets that live inside our nonprofit communities by working more closely together and aligning the things that we do. So we were able to take pieces of Tech Garden incubation and some pro-literacy, language development and all of the sort of partners that come from the North Side Up model and make sure that this was something that has the opportunities for lots of success for these entrepreneurs. So, you know, we have a few there that we could call out. We have Curtis Washington's in the lower left position. It's sort of like, I just realized it's sort of this Brady Bunch look to it. It's kind of cool. Curtis, That's What's Up. He runs a food truck business, so sort of a comfort and soul food with a bit of fusion and high style food offerings. Aaron Mehta is up in the top. He's in the upper right. He's doing Salt City Coffee, so roasting and really about the sourcing, the selection of coffees from all these experiential places. Faseha Axum Earth Management. He's in the right column center position, really looking at some of his African cultural background in how you take that and translate that into gardening and lawn service and sort of maintenance of property. So Hari Adhikari, he's up in the upper left with the stylish fedora. He's opening a Bhutanese restaurant, but it's really like a house. It's a cultural center. There'll be art, there'll be performances, there'll be pieces of clothing and a whole experience, right? Leslie Morris is working on stages, sort of the idea of gifts with purpose and comfort to those that are battling long-term illnesses like cancer. And Loretta Bacchus, she's Soul of a Diva. That's S-O-L-E. And the purpose there is she wants to really change the way that sort of shoes and accessories are purchased. Wide stylings, opportunities to, when she shops for shoes, she has a trouble finding her sizes, and she never wants that to happen again. And so it's really unique to see how they all rally together, see how they work and interplay with each other, and have come together now for this year in these sort of two stages of incubation. So I just want to touch on just a few things. It is a unique solution. It is a unique combination of business literacy, taking some of the pieces of software accelerators where you sort of have stages and prizes and pitching and demo days. You're taking tech incubation and the ideas of incubators, neighborhood and community development, and financial and micro-enterprise development. So we hope that the long-term potential is that these could be replicable. The format of this social enterprise could be replicable to targeted neighborhoods or social or demographic audiences anywhere. It works best as small and local where everyone knows each other, but could you pick that up and effectively stamp that into different areas to drive the same sort of positive change? We also think the long-term potential is just an abundance of more successful businesses that anchor neighborhoods, that contribute to real estate sustainability and storefronts and things of that nature. And then we also believe that there's some new financing vehicles. Could programs and engagement in social enterprise be as powerful of an indicator to lenders as a FICO score? There are ways that we are de-risking businesses that should open up more access to capital. It's a matter of driving those opportunities for these entrepreneurs. There's always challenges. There's always like every business incubator, right? You're like, oh, 1 in 20 make it. That's awesome, right? So that's not kind of the same mentality you want to take when you're working with more of these sustainable service model businesses. So we're always looking for technical assistance. If anyone would ever want to volunteer or mentor or coach a team or, maybe CPAs or law firms or other professional service providers you might know that could lend some time and expertise, would be amazing. Continue to think about access to capital. That's something that we look at in a long-term challenge. And then I think also sort of just getting entrepreneurs and business owners for the first time to really sort of understand that idea of path to market, right? It's you don't want to make it daunting. It is easy in a lot of ways, tongue-in-cheek. But you got to understand what it's going to take to get from your concept to your customers, and sort of that path to market is as much of an intention and a step and a planning as it is about what shoes you want to carry or what types of gardens you want to plant or what types of food you want to offer. So many times our entrepreneurs from the high-tech world and from service and traditional businesses just sort of forget that middle. So that's part of our challenges as well. But all in all, it's been amazing to sort of integrate and work into a little bit different sort of a boundary spanner for the tech garden, and been amazing to coordinate, collaborate with a lot of new partners. So I appreciate your time and our opportunity to tell you a little about Upstart.
Thank you, Seth. One other kind of just quick piece around the potential. One of the things we've also really started to identify is that all the folks that you see there, first of all, you have six individuals, and there's really kind of another person who's in that mix, who have been in this program now for a year and have gone purely from concept to every single one of them now is manifested their business at a micro level and is generating revenue of some kind. And so it's really amazing to see that people who were completely out of the market are in the market now and have persisted in their spare time over a year to get there. So it's a testament, obviously, to the great partners we have at the table. I did want to acknowledge Eric Rogers from SCORE, who is, in fact, helping us mentor, and many others across the community from the Small Business Development Center to Cooperative Federal Credit Union, a lot of other partners that have helped us deliver the kind of core services in this model. But the fact that we have six people who a year later are going strong and showing signs of hope to really fully launch a business, that's really exciting. One of the other things we've noticed is that, man, this model is applicable to a lot of existing business owners. You just, look at where our offices are on the north side. Dozens of small business owners, ethnic business owners, who frankly are struggling with a lot of these same challenges and questions, and they already have skin in the game. Can we help them stabilize, scale, grow, and become more vibrant parts of our economy? So I think that's something where we hope to kind of evolve as well. But at any rate, we're really appreciative of your time and listening to all our models, and now would open up the floor for questions to any one of us.
Great. Thank you. Here we go.
Dominic, I'm wondering if there's a minimum living wage that you operate off of.
That's a great question. Minimum living wage that we operate off of. Frankly, there's some standard definitions for a living wage that are prescribed by the state and prescribed by, different advocacy organizations. If you take like a SaltWorks, for instance, what we basically tried to do for our two employees is essentially do a baseline salary or a baseline wage of $15 an hour plus benefits. You do the math on that, and it's not going to make anybody wealthy, but we at least feel like, you can pay rent, make a car payment, and provide for your family at the most basic level in that regard. And, hopefully that's a starting point.
Good morning. One of the things we found out with the OCL study last year, I'm also on the Visions for Change board through Housing Visions, and it's talked about a lot, is transportation for folks. Do you guys have that problem, and how do you overcome it? Because I think it's an opportunity for us as a community.
Well, I know for SaltWorks, when we started out and initially hired Pedro and Luis, both of them were community residents, and our wood shop is in the Near West Side. We share a space with Habitat for Humanity building. So things, Pedro and Luis were getting to work by either riding their bikes or walking. But since we're consistently paying them a living wage, over time, they were able to afford their own car payment and do transportation that way.
So for Project Joseph, we actually provide the transportation so that our employees can get to the job site in the morning, meet as a team, go out with the crews, and then we figure out ways to get them home at the end of the day.
I guess, I could speak more broadly to, the workforce development work that, we're a part of in this community, and in general, transportation is, I think it's a huge barrier, and it's a byproduct of a lot of our kind of spatial inefficiencies in our community. We've had massive sprawl. We don't have, a lot of population density, so it makes really good public transportation difficult to pull off. For a long time, we've been trying to either create opportunities or focus opportunities in the center city so that transportation wasn't an issue. Putting on my workforce development hat, as we start to grow and scale economic opportunities, i.e. jobs, and we start kind of identifying a broader swath of employers, that's a huge challenge. And I think that it's really about, it's going to have to be about creating alternatives to our traditional public transit system. And until we start, building more density and bringing more companies back into the, kind of urban core, it's going to have to, we're going to have to rethink just the standard, central model. Central's constrained by the economics of what they're trying to do. There's, again, critical mass. It's difficult. So how do we kind of mobilize smaller vehicles that are specific to the opportunity, things like that? So those are all kind of ongoing conversations, but I think it's been fairly universally identified as a critical challenge.
Sorry. You mentioned the word marketing. The only parallel I can use is like the gambling casinos. They say they have a limited pool of people. In other words, you open more casinos, but you're going to get X amount of customers. Have you any marketing arm or training to do enough research to find out how many customers you can possibly draw from? How many people are going to be interested in your contemporary furniture? What is your market so that you can grow? Are you in a viable, sustainable business? In other words, that question, is it addressed in any training or any research groups or any marketing facilities? As an artist, I know how hard it is to find your customers. Do you have any facet of that to keep these businesses going?
I think I'll start with two pieces from sort of the entrepreneurship training model inside Upstart. First is that through SBDCs, we sort of encourage and build into the small business development centers. Thank you. And they're often centered throughout the state at community colleges. OCC and Oswego have participating ones here that are pretty close and active. But we build into the curriculum a marketing component. It's part of their modules they must learn, and they must sit with an SBDC counselor to tap the SUNY research library, so they can ask specific marketing questions like, how many competitors might I have in a 50-mile radius? Or, I'm selling a product that's targeted for, you know, middle American consumers. How many homes between 1,000 and 3,000 square feet? You know, in certain, so they can get sort of that real demographic information. And we have sort of bankers and the SBDC counselors sort of reviewing and sort of doing the some numbers and figures help, but they're sort of translating that into a reality check of how do you get to those customers. So the first is sort of the research component. The second is that we critically, and this is part of that whole leveraging of what you've already developed with your tech incubator and your neighborhood development, community development, social development opportunities, we have, for the past 18 months, had a paid marketing executive in residence. This is a gentleman who has a 25-year career as a serial entrepreneur. The last 10 have been spent at EMA here locally, who is the marketing guru. So he was the gentleman in the front corner probably clapping the loudest at the pitch event. So pitch coaching and, you know, the three P's of marketing, you know, product placement, positioning, all of those things are inherently woven into because that's it. That's the path to market. There are so many great ideas and there's so many great products, but it's not a business until lots of people are buying them. So how do you get into the hands of those consumers?
I'll follow up on that. So I want to hire Project Joseph people. I want to buy a Saltworks table. I want to buy a ticket to the Miami Tummy. So how do I do that? You have websites. You have places, Facebook pages. How are we doing that right now?
So for Project Joseph, we're taking down all your names, and we'll be out tomorrow to do some property services for you. So yeah, we haven't done a ton of marketing, to be honest with you. Part of that is trying to calibrate the staffing for Project Joseph. But we have a website. You can call our main number 424-1800 at Catholic Charities. For us, our focus is really around a couple different customer segments. We're going to work very closely with the diocese around school buildings and churches. We're going to work with other not-for-profits. And there's some individual homeowners that we see opportunity for that we're doing some very specific marketing towards. But more for us down the road.
Saltworks also has a website that everything is based out of. And in addition to that, we do local events that are happening. So the Salt Market is a craft fair that's coming up in October, and we'll have an exhibit there where we have some of our pieces and that you get a little taste of what we're making. And then you can view the website or talk to me, and I'd love to give you a wood shop tour, and you can see the stuff that we're making. And we are also focused on, as Project Joseph, we're really looking into business to business, and so trying to identify the people who we need to talk to who are interested in doing renovations or building new buildings or re-outfitting their offices and trying to get larger projects. So we just did a large installation in St. Joseph's Hospital in their new expansion, and so those are the types of jobs that we'd really like to go after so that we can do batch processing for manufacturing our pieces.
I swore I'd never go on Facebook. This is the longest I've gone without checking it now. I'm extremely active on Facebook. I'm there once or twice a day. There's so much going on. There's so many people to meet. I mean, just the what people are cooking in their homes or the markets on the north side. There's just so much to share that's going on beyond the 2 days a year that we do something. But in addition to that, we're trying to market ourselves by having more events in other places. We are trying to break into the Ithaca market. We have an event down in New York City. That we're bringing a bunch of our chefs down there in a couple of months, which is cool and exciting. And so when we go into different locales, that's the hope that we can sort of broadcast what we're doing. We're also talking with other with people in different cities up here, like in Utica and Rochester and Buffalo, and trying to sort of see if anybody there wants to replicate this or partner with us. So the more places we can sort of appear, the more people will get talking about things. We also have gorgeous posters. I'm so lucky. We have such a great designer, and they're right outside the door. You're free to pick one up. And we have an event on October 4th, and we have an event this Saturday. And I think that's the last thing I just want to say about that is that partnering up has really been a boon for us. And so this Saturday, we're visiting five different countries up at the farm, up at Kirkville for Syracuse Grows. So that's so cool. What a great thing to do during the fall, right? But it's also great just in finding like-minded people and partnering with them on events. I think that's the way to really get things out. I hate to say synergy. Everybody says synergy, but synergy.
Not so much.
Thanks.
It's still a good word. It's okay, Adam. Lisa, you have a question?
Let's see. Compliments. Oh. Sorry, we have a new rule. Compliments on all of these activities because we know how difficult it can be. And I'm really encouraged by the focus on consumables because all of us have so much stuff already we don't really need anymore, but we all have to eat. So it's great that My Lucky Tummy, you're doing as well as you are, but it really would be so nice to have a food court here. And I know, Dominic, you've been working on this for quite some time. Can you talk about and give us a hint as to what might be coming? Is there something planned that... we all know, and you all worked so hard on the Bluebird grant, that didn't happen, but at least it was the effort to pull together a lot of people to focus on that activity. Do we have some hope of having some place we can go to, either on a consistent basis or maybe once a week or once a month, where we can pick up, take away, or something on a more simple model than what you've got put together there, Adam? Thanks.
Yeah, no, thanks. Whenever I talk about the Bloomberg, you know, competition, it's a little hard to swallow still, but you know, Heidi Holt and I spent too many hours until the wee hours of the morning trying to put together an application that we thought was just amazing, and you know, to not get the $5 million was a little, you know, difficult. But no, the reality is that the idea that we came up with for the Bloomberg competition, which was to create an international food court that showcased local chefs, both from, you know, our you know, kind of homegrown Syracuse community, as well as our international communities who could showcase different foods to our community, and in doing so, develop their own skill sets and move along. You know, that's still a very big dream of ours. It's something that we're still writing funding applications for. We got a couple out there right now, and at least to kind of start iteratively pecking away at it. We're still looking at that same site on the north side that's owned by St. Joe's. We've been having some conversations with St. Joe's and OCC about putting some programming in that site to start with and growing that to the point where we could actually have a full-time marketplace. The really exciting piece for me personally is that in the midst of kind of ideating that whole, you know, concept and pitching it publicly, I heard about this guy that had just moved to Syracuse named Adam Sudman, who was starting a business called My Lucky Tummy. And one of the things we always said was, well, who would ever manage this food court? And, you know, who would ever, you know, be able to pull it together? So, you know, if we ever can create that infrastructure, I think we have the business that can kind of slide into it, hopefully someday, you know, that we, if we could ever create that canvas, we have our artist. So so that's exciting. You know, that's a big deal. So hope springs eternal, you know, but big audacious ideas often take time to implement, but we're still very hopeful for it. So,
good morning. My name is Juanita Perez Williams, and some of you may recognize me. I've been a staffer and local and state government. And one of the things that I've been very interested in is this new concept of social enterprise in government, and that many, especially municipalities throughout the country, are thinking of ways to sustain themselves by being involved in social enterprise, and at the same time working with organizations such as yours to serve those who are paying into the local municipality. And one of the things I found that is really seen in all of your organizations, which has been the most successful, and I'm curious about your thoughts on this, is you are all raising awareness of culture in communities and new communities coming to this country. And these partnerships really not only educate those that are coming from faraway lands, but they educate people that are already in these communities and to what's out there and how they can give. And so I'm curious if any of you have actually worked with our local municipalities and have thought about ways in working to kind of raise awareness in culture with regards to municipalities.
So I think I may have the most direct flow through of publicly supported, municipally supported dollars that then are sort of invested into companies and entrepreneurs that then are hoped to be the evergreen funds to continue our operations and then therefore stop asking from the public sources in the first place, right? So I'm not exactly sure how to keep engaging more of that. I feel, however, I can say, particularly from the Tech Garden perspective, but after the past year and a half of planning and rolling out and creating Upstart and listening to the partners, there is without a doubt that social enterprises have got to be the most capitally efficient firms or the ways of delivering services to a market that I have seen. Pinching pennies does not even begin to describe how much they can do with so little. So it is the anti-largesse kind of things that we think about, oh, municipal money and taxes and things like that. So, you know, I think the more ways, maybe it's starting with things that are already existing, like how do we get more of these social enterprises competitively bidding on public RFPs. Maybe it's approaching traditional volunteer activities and seeing if there's social entrepreneurship. Maybe it's things like OCRA and sort of the upcycling of, so I mean, everyone, I think, feels those opportunity sets. It's just there's not been a traditional mechanism that brings municipal and social enterprises together other than the traditional, that's where I go every now and again for a line item allocation from some budget, right? So I applaud that line of thinking. I think it would translate to better returns on publicly invested dollars. And maybe that's the next challenge we should all walk away with, is how do we think about that municipal engagement?
And I would just be remiss if I did not acknowledge really quickly, you know, we've been trying to identify a few key places where those things can intersect. One is, can we use, you know, public funds, whether from an IDA or, you know, other types of entities, to back and source and create financing and equity for either underserved businesses or social enterprises, so some sort of non-traditional equity or financing source. And then there's some of that already in our community, but can we grow that and can we diversify that? Contracts with government, yes, and you mentioned OCRA. I think waste stream diversion is a huge opportunity that we're not even remotely tapping into yet, so partially the Saltworks model, but even beyond that. And then maybe even being contracted out for municipal services. So, you know, there are times where people could be, you know, like we had conversations a couple years ago with the county around maintaining some of the green infrastructure improvements. We didn't have our capacity at a point yet where we could really deliver that kind of service. But, you know, if they came to us today, I think we'd be really excited about that. So you know, a few different, just very more pointed comments there.
Thank you. Thank you, Dominic Robinson, Mike Malara, Janie Mills, Adam Suddenman, Seth Mulligan. That was very, very, very informative and interesting. And Dominic, we've talked about a program maybe in the spring semester about the work train, green train, health train programs, and hope you'll all return. So thank you very much.